Board.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Let me also recognize Government Counsel, Mr. Axelrod, who are excellent advocates. All the lawyers on our side have done a wonderful job in this case, particularly to Elio and his sister, Cadi. Mr. Dwyer ended his argument giving you a list of things he said this case was about. But this case is not about any of those things. This is a tax case. What this case is about is whether the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Elio Castroneves obtained income that he willfully, intentionally, and criminally evaded, did not report, and did not pay the tax on. That's what this case is about. This case is not about his father's tax returns, or his father's income, or his father's corporations. It's not about Coimex's executives and what they were doing with their taxes. It's not about whether Coimex was avoiding any kind of currency transactions. It's not about Seven Corporation, because Seven is irrelevant to this case, I believe, and I think you will agree with me. It's a red herring. And it's not about these legal fictions that the government has dug out of the 5,600 pages of the Internal Revenue Code, such things as attribution and control foreign corporations and indemnification and all those kind of words. This case is not about that at all. This is whether that young man sitting over there willfully and intentionally and criminally, with knowledge, did not report his income and pay the taxes on it. And I believe I can show you he did none of that. And the government has failed in its burden of proof. The court's going to give you an instruction on this concept that you've heard from the beginning of this case called constructive receipt. You've heard from our expert on it. You've heard from what the IRS claims a constructive receipt is. None of that matters once the court speaks, because it is the court that gives us the law that you are to follow. And this is what constructive receipt is. Income must be reported when it is actually or constructively received. Correct. Income is constructively received when an individual has earned and is due money, when he has earned the money. The money is immediately available to him. The key words there, immediately available. And his failure to receive it is due entirely to his own volition. If a taxpayer requests deferral of income prior to receiving an unconditional vested right to the income, the taxpayer has not constructively received it. That is 98% of this case, right there. Take out everything that was said by everybody in the course of this trial. This is the law that each of you must follow on your oath. Did he have unconditional vested right to the income before the letter was sent to Penske on December 15, 1999? The unquestionable evidence in this case, taking a look at the licensing agreement, it is right there in black and white. He does not vest, he is not entitled to a dime under the licensing agreement until January 1, year 2000. 15 days later, he stopped, or his lawyer stopped the payment before it was vested, before it was due. Under the law that you will get, once that happens, there is no constructive receipt. This fiction of reconstructive receipt is exactly that. It's just a fiction. And in this case, it simply does not apply. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of 98% of the charges in this case. Because $5 million was properly stopped before it was vested and due to be paid. And therefore, Elio Castroneves did not constructively received this money, and he was not required to pay tax on it, and he does not have to pay tax on it until he actually receives it, according to the law. Now, you've heard a lot of evidence in this case about his father, Elio Sr., and we presented him as a witness. I had a professor in college who always said, when there's an elephant in the room, introduce it. And he's the elephant in this room. One of the ironies of this case is the government says, did he really do any work for the money he received? The question is not that. The question is, did he do too much? Was he too much in his son's life? I know many of you know people like this that were frustrated athletes or frustrated in some type of something they wanted to do desperately, that they wanted to be good at, they wanted to be great. They thought they could be that person but never quite made it. And then what do? They live through their children. They push their children into something. And what happens when they have a child who has talent? You see that parent there doing everything they can. Sometimes it's over the top. And I think Elio Sr. at times here was over the top. And you saw what he was like. This young boy, starting at 8 years old, was being pushed. Now, granted, he wanted to, but can you imagine the kinds of pressures that were put on him as a child? Do you think he had a lot of choice in things that were going on? How many times have you seen parents like that on the ball fields or in the swimming pools or any kind of athletic endeavor in this community? Multiply that times 10, and that's what we're dealing with Elio Sr. We're all human beings. We all have relationships. We all have relationships with our parents. Who among us as a child does not listen to their parent? Every single philosophy and religion there is has as one of their number one commandments, honor thy father and mother. And don't we do that? Don't we have unquestioned love for our parents? These are the people who feed us, who clothe us, who educate us, who guide us in life, guide us through everything important. Don't we, most of our lives, try to find ways to repay that love? Don't we have an incredible bond with our parents? No matter their faults, no matter what mistakes they do, how often do we do everything we can to try to show our love to them? This is a classic human emotion, probably the greatest. Love is the greatest human emotion there is. A love between the parents and the child is as great a love there is. And no matter what perfections there may be, we overlook them. And we spend their lives seeking to justify their love. And what did this man, Elio Sr., do for his son? He may have been obsessed, but think about what he did. He took a boy who was driving a car who couldn't even get a name on it. He's there with a question mark. It's almost at an end. He's running out of money. He's done an incredible job doing everything he can to support his son. And less than 10 years later, through his efforts, this boy from a small town in Brazil goes from go-karts and cars without a name on it to being top of the world. Two times in a row winning the Indianapolis 500 and missing the third time by a couple of thousandths of a second. That's what this man did for his son. He sacrificed everything, sold all his property, bankrupted his company, spent day and night working with him, every weekend, working with this young boy to become this man, this champion
this star on top of the world, how much is that worth?
Could we even put a number on that? I don't know that we can. But I have to ask you this. While it's hard to put a number on this, is there anybody can say it's a crime to repay this man for what he did? Is it a crime? A crime in this country, this day and age, for him to understand the moral and legal and financial obligation he had to his father who took him from nothing to this, and they say this is a crime that without a receipt, without a contract, at 12 years old he should have had his father sign some sort of a contract, I suppose, and that makes it a crime for him to pay his father who spent everything he had. But what happened to this concept of family values? Is there any more family value than this? What are we going to do? Reward the people who ignore those who help them, who don't pay back their parents, who don't help them at all, who go away and say thanks but no thanks? Is that what this is all about? Is that what we've come to? It has to be a contract? What happened to love and affection and everything that went into this young boy's life? Don't you think he had an obligation to return this? Let me tell you, my God, I just hope there is one. And they say the father getting $500,000, and I know that's a lot of money, but the father getting $500,000 is a crime. That's less than a third of the actual money he put out, let alone his time for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years of work. And that $500,000, that's less than 10% of the contract from Penske. Less than 10%. Emerson Fittipaldi sued him to get 20% and did nothing. He spent a year. Emerson Fittipaldi spent a year supposedly trying to find sponsorship, of which he never found, and yet he claimed he was entitled to 20%. Of this man's income, and his father, who did everything, who bankrupted himself, spent every day with him, gets just under 10%, and that, they say, is totally unjustified. And who in this family made the financial decisions? Does anybody really think that Elio Castroneves Jr. ever made a financial decision? When it came to racing, all he did was drive, and drive he did. And he had the courage and the fortitude and the strength and the ability to do it. But here's a young man who never went to college, never worked in a business, never really left the family home until he came here to race. Even when he went to England, his mother went with him and lived with him. He was always taken care of in the family. He didn't make decisions independent of his father. You saw his father on the witness stand. You think his father allowed Elio Jr. to make financial decisions? Who raised the money from Council and CoinMix and Buddha Beer and all of those sponsors? And who went to Caixa Bank and signed all those documents? Who got all the money? Was it Elio Jr.? Not once. Not once did he do anything about money. All he did was drive. And now he focuses on driving 250 miles an hour. That's what he's good at. He's not good at the rest of those things. And take a look at the documents and evidence. Every important document, it's all his father's doing. Here is Government's Exhibit 85. This is supposedly financial document exchange with Elio. Who signs it? I know you recognize that signature. Signed by his father. Another one. Currency transaction on behalf of the buyer is Elio Alves de Castroneves. That's Government's Exhibit 86. Who signs it? Elio Sr. Here is, take a look at Government's Exhibit 75. This is the translated version. This is the Brazilian tax return for Elio Jr., his tax return. Who signs his tax return? Elio Sr.
It's on evidence, Your Honor.
What exhibit are you referencing, Mr. Black?
Is that 75.
Not? 75.
Government Exhibit 75. Well, I'll move on anyway. I assume that was in evidence.
All right. Well, the jury will have the items in evidence, and they will make that determination. Let's move on, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Government's Exhibit 76, more foreign exchange. Who is it signed by? Elio Sr. Foreign exchange. These are all the COIMEX transactions. Who is it signed by? Elio Sr. Who is it signed by? Elio Sr. Wire transfers for 7 promotions. Who is it signed by? Elio Sr. Wire transfers for 7 promotions. Who is it signed by? Elio Sr. Take a look at these documents. You can recognize his signature. Safra Bank, an account for Elio Alves de Castro Neves, signed by, not Elio, his father. The first COIMEX transaction, Elio Alves de Castro Neves. Who signs on behalf of Elio, or claims to be Elio? His father. Then the second one that replaced this is signed by Elio Alves, but it's in May, I think 26th. You can see it there, the stamps. Take a look at it. That is when he's there for the Rio race, and they use him for a signature then. All of these documents are signed by his father. All the finances were done, not by Elio Jr., Elio Sr. And you know that from listening to his testimony. This is the man who was in charge all those years. It was not Elio. It was his father. The government told you this morning that this case is about fairness. And somehow what Elio has done is unfair according to our tax code. Well, our tax code is not based on fairness, and it is not fair. And the government, who are represented by these gentlemen here, have created a tax code which is not fair and equal. Warren Buffett, the world's second richest man, pays taxes at a lower tax rate than his secretary. Is that fair? Why are hedge funds and stock investments taxed at a maximum of 15%? And yet, if a person puts their money in a savings account, it can be taxed up to 35%. Is that fair? How is it that in the year 2009, the inheritance tax is 45%, and next year, 2010, it's zero? And then in 2011, it goes up to 45% on inheritance over $1 million. Is this based on fairness? It has nothing to do with fairness. Congress creates the tax code. It gives people incentives. It creates and forces people into human behavior. If they want you to buy a house, they give you a bigger deduction for your interest. If they want you to give to charity, they give you a bigger deduction for charity. This year, they don't want you to give your money to charity, so they reduce the deduction. That's what our government does. This idea that everybody pays the same tax is a myth they're trying to push in this courtroom and to somehow use it against Elio. He is using provisions of the code which Congress passed and is the law of the land, and he has the right to use them. And we're talking about fairness. Let's talk about fairness to Elio for a second. He is a non-immigrant person. He has an O-1 visa, which means he stays here as long as he is driving, and no longer. And what benefits does he get? What benefits does he get that all the rest of us get from paying taxes? He gets no Social Security, gets no Medicare. You think when he goes back to River Oak Crato and takes his Medicare card to the local drugstore, they're going to give him his prescriptions? Or his doctor is going to treat him on that? Is that fair? He doesn't get any education here. He doesn't get permanent residency. He doesn't get citizenship. He doesn't have the right to vote. He has to ask for permission to travel. He has to renew his visa. And guess what? The Immigration Service can throw him out whenever they want. Congress can change the law tomorrow and exclude him. Tomorrow. And we know there are people up there who want to do it. And what happens if something happens to him? What happens when he is going 250 miles an hour and he hits another car or hits the wall and he's crippled or loses his legs or has brain damage? Who's going to take care of him? Because as soon as that happens, he's out of a job and he's out of this country. Who is going to take care of him? That's why they create funds like a retirement fund for people like this. Lawyers know this. How many times have you seen some of the great athletes of our time? We see them in their glory. We love them. We go to the games. We cheer for them. We see them playing. And then what happens when their knees give out? When their back is destroyed? When they have brain damage? How about these guys in the NFL who have so many concussions today, they have brain damage and cannot even work? Who takes care of them? How many times have we seen young athletes like this? How many times have we seen, you know, the Don Kings of the world take all the money and a guy like Mike Tyson, before you know it, is out on the street? That's because they didn't have anything like this. Now they do. This is the kind of protection people need. And it's not only that, but you talk about fairness. This is justice. Isn't it justice if something happens to this young man? And let's face it, in that sport, it can happen quicker than that. And it's all over. And he's back in Brazil with nothing. This is the kind of funds, this is how this works. This is his cushion, something to take care of him. Because the United States government's not going to do it. No matter how much he pays in taxes, he's not going to get any of those benefits. One of the things that I think are really unfair about this case is the way they do this coinment. Every time it comes up, they keep saying, well, do you know that Elio Castroneves got $2 million from Coinmex in 1999, 2000, and 2001? The mantra over and over again, he got $2 million to every witness. Did you know he got $2 million? Well, guess what? We all know he didn't get $2 million. Even their own chart shows he didn't get $2 million. He got $50,000. Yet the mantra over and over again, I guess if you repeat it enough, people will buy it, that he got $2 million. It doesn't matter that it went into his account. He's the one who said, follow the money. Where did it end up? Who got the money? Coinmex got most of the money. His father got the rest. Assad, the broker, got some. It went into his father's child funds account. It didn't go to Elio. $50,000 of it went to him. $50,000 out of $6 million. That's what he got, and he reported it. He's supposed to report how in the world could he report on his income taxes $2 million every year? What's he going to do to pay it with? And Mr. Dwyer said, well, in 1999, Hogan was paying his expenses. He didn't need that $50,000. But that's not the evidence. The evidence is that Mr. Fittipaldi was supposed to pay Mr. Hogan and never did. So for 6 months, Hogan never paid Elio Castroneves, and he had no money. He is here in the United States with an obligation to go to these races, and he doesn't even have the money to pay for tickets to go there, to pay for his meals, to pay for the hotel, to pay for his apartment here. That's why he needed this money. That's why his father made this deal. We may not like this deal that they did down in Brazil, in the third world, not the United States of America, but down in Brazil. We may not like what the father did here, but you know what? He knew that his son was desperate. He didn't have a dime. He's up here by himself, and they won't even pay him. Because Emerson Fittipaldi, the great Fittipaldi, one of the world's great racing drivers, never fulfilled his agreement. So the father once again took over. The father, who they say never does any work, who doesn't deserve anything, came to the rescue. And Mr. Dwyer tells you that the $1.8 million he's responsible for, and the ones from Chalfont, because it's like going to Burger King. Like going to Burger King. That's the way they sum up this case, like going to Burger King. He didn't spend this money. It didn't end up with him. He didn't buy a car. He didn't buy even a burger with it. To say that this is like going to Burger King, I think it's just a silly argument. And he also said, well, why would you put $5 million in a company you don't own? Well, he put the same $5 million into Vintage in the Netherlands. He doesn't own that company. Doesn't own a bit of it. And when let's talk about that for a second. How many of us, they say, well, you would never put your investment money in a company that you don't own. How many of us know where our 401ks are? How many of us know who's running that? Or how many of us know today who's running Merrill Lynch? If there still is a Merrill Lynch, I'm not even sure. Or Citicorp, or Wachovia, or any of these investment programs. How many of us know who these people are? We don't. Let's face it. We don't know who it is. And let's turn this around a little bit, this idea about Seven and the father and who's responsible for the income and the taxes. Assume for a minute that the people in Brazil indict Elio Sr. for tax evasion. Well, let's just assume that for a minute. That you didn't report the money from Seven, you didn't report that you own a stock in Seven, and you didn't report your income. What would the case against Elio Sr. be? Well, they were bearer shares. They were either in the hands of your lawyer or in your hands. And if it's in your lawyer's hands, you're responsible for it. You did all the work. You negotiated the deal with Coimex. You signed your son's name. You received the money. You sent the money to your corporation, Chalfont's Trade Corporation. Your lawyer created the corporation. Your lawyer testified that we have stipulated to that you own the corporation. The evidence will be you either controlled it through your lawyer or you owned it. And guess what? You want to blame it on your son? There's not a single fact, not a single fact to show that your son owned any of this. That would be the case against him in Brazil. It's a far stronger case than they brought against the son here. As you know, on November 5th of 1999, Elio signed five contracts. These are the contracts, which of course you will be able to read. In civil law, when you sign a contract, you are responsible for it whether you read it or not. That's how we do it in a civil context. It doesn't make any difference whether you understood it, whether you read it, you signed it, you are responsible. But not in a criminal context, because crime requires specific intent. You have to intend to violate the law. You have to do something intentionally, knowingly. And with taxes, you have to know the consequences of what you do. We know
from the times on the documents, there's no way that this young man read and understood these contracts. They were all completed on the afternoon of November 4th at either 4 o'clock, 3:30, or 3:45, and were signed the next morning. I know we went through some parts of these documents here. It was boring. It was hard to go through. There are 39 pages of documents there, and some of them are even conflicting. Trying to figure them out as a lawyer is difficult. But I challenge you to go through these documents and make head or tail of them. I challenge you to do that. And what happened? He sat with his lawyer who went through the first two pages, Mark Seiden, of the driver's agreement, and it was too much. He said, I'm tired and I have to go to bed, because it was late at night. And they were signed the next morning. And I guarantee you there's a big table there. All the contracts are open to the page, and they'll have a little indication, just like here. You take a look at, right there were LEO signatures. They have a little arrow. That's in Portuguese. I assume it says sign here. They have the same thing here. They put a little sticky or an arrow. You just sign here, because that's all you do, is you sign these contracts. Nobody discussed it with them. No lawyers explained it to them. Nobody walked them through it. Nobody tried to translate it for him. And how did this mistake occur? How was it, you know, the government relies so much on the promotional representation agreement that it says that he owns the beneficial or legal ownership of the share capital. Well, let's take a look at Defendant's Exhibit 183. How could this mistake be made? If you look at the facts part of the page up there, this was faxed by Feingold to Mr. Miller's office at almost 12 minutes to 6 p.m. on Thursday afternoon. This went into his office after Mr. Miller had already left. And what is in this document? This has the language that is critical to our case. Feingold, for the first time, puts in that language, whereas Moore owns legally or beneficially all the share capital of GME. That's the one that gets copied verbatim, except for Moore's name in Ilio's contract. And down here, what does he add to Grant? As a contribution to the capital, Moore grants GME an exclusive license to use the marks. That all comes late Thursday evening, or in the evening, late in the afternoon, to Miller's office on Thursday. That is put into Moore's contract in the next day or two, which is signed. But then, of course, as we know, Greg Moore unfortunately died. And Mr. Miller is not in his office most of the next week, and they copy them into the agreements for Elio, and those two things get repeated verbatim on Elio's contract. Contract he didn't read. Even if he read it, do you think that he understood what legally or beneficially all the share capital? Do you think he knows what share capital is? Or down here, he's granting to Seven, as a contribution to its capital, an exclusive license to use the mark. Now, do you think that Elio Castroneves knows what a contribution to capital is in corporation law, of which nobody explained to him? Even if he read it, he wouldn't understand that. Few people would. They brought up that Elio, when he testified at the civil trial, said he didn't sign the agreement with Seven. We have to put that in context. Number one, they have only shown you a small part of the testimony.
You take a look at it, you will see they very carefully cut out certain pages.
Just overrule, but Mr. Black make reference to the evidence without they.
Yes, sir, I'm sorry. You will see in those books that you just take a look at the page numbers. You can tell how much is missing. And what is missing? One of the most important things is that they had a contract that was unsigned by Elio at that trial. You can tell from that question by the lawyer, well, I understand you didn't sign it, and they have it right there in their hands in the courtroom. And we've introduced it into evidence as Defendant's Exhibit 18A. This is the agreement of March 9, 1999. And if you take a look, there is a copy of the agreement which is signed by everybody. It has all the various signatures and certificates and all of that. It's everybody except Elio. And this is what they were using at that trial, and that's why Elio was saying he didn't sign it. So without the entire context of that trial, it's hard to put things, to understand things. You can't just take things isolated and try to figure them out. Now, were mistakes made here? Yes, they were. Why were mistakes made? What was it that caused this? Well, we human beings have been evolving for many millennia, but we are still imperfect. We have design flaws. We make mistakes all the time. Our eyes play tricks on us. Our ears do. Our memory does. We don't tell the same story the same way twice. We make mistakes all the time about things. And add to that, today, our speeded up world. How fast are things going today? How many of us are juggling things, sending the kids to school, fixing breakfast or lunch, going to the office, driving the car, talking on your cell phone, texting on your BlackBerry or on your phone at the same time? How many of us in this world are doing too many things at one time? And the more we do, and the faster we do it, the more mistakes we make. Why do you think we have delete buttons on the computers and erasures? And the one that always aggravates me, when you rent a car and the GPS system is always telling you you made a mistake in the wrong turn in one of those annoying voices. We have all these things because we make mistakes all the time. And let me give you some examples. We just watched on national television the President of the United States take the inaugural oath. There are two men, John Roberts, who's the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, one of the world's smartest men. We have Barack Obama, who unquestionably is one of the most accomplished men in the world, if not in our history. And yet, in an oath that's 35 words long, neither one of them got it right. We have, I think statistics show, 636,000 accidents happen a year because people are multitasking or talking on their phones while driving. The one that I love, not love, the one that I think hits the most, there was a study about anesthesiologists, some of the world's smartest people running operations, and they found that there was a too high death rate in the mid-90s. And they examined it, and they found there were two machines that they used for anesthesiology. In one, the dial turned clockwise, and in the other, the dial turned counterclockwise. And they found out just that simple thing, that mistake that could be made, caused more than 1 out of 5,000 people to die during operations. They fixed that and reduced that by 40-fold. That one change. This is what we're human beings. I mean, we can't forget that when we're looking at what these people did. We're not perfect. Lawyers are not perfect. Alan Miller's not perfect. Elio Castroneves and his sister are not perfect. I know it's hard for us at times when we judge other people. We always want to judge them with this idea they should never make a mistake and they're responsible for their mistake. But when we judge ourselves, we understand it. We make mistakes all the time. It's part of the human condition. We can't help it. Even the government. Our government makes mistakes. I mean, we spend $30 billion a year on intelligence, and yet we couldn't find weapons of mass destruction. We didn't know North Korea had nuclear bombs. We couldn't fix New Orleans after the hurricane. Despite all the things that they have, they make mistakes. It's just the human condition. It happens. And the pressure here to sign this contract was great. Penske was in a bind. They had all these contracts. They had these sponsors. They had this team together. Greg Moore died. Think about this. Their driver, the next great driver, this young man full of talent and vitality, goes out there and is killed in a horrible accident. And what do? They immediately get on the phone and look for a replacement. Because they're under pressure to get things done. They're pushing it. And when you push and their speed, there's going to be mistakes. And you know what? A mistake was made here. An honest mistake. And yet it's like a virus. It's infected this case from the beginning to the end. The government will not recognize it. They think that everything is sinister. They don't see that people make mistakes. It just happens. And Elio Castroneves had and paid a large number of professionals to help him here. This is not as if he went out and did this stuff and said, well, I'm going to hide my income. He had an accountant in Miami who was replaced by Savory, who was an expert on motor racing. Jill Combs, who is one of their accountants, never talked to Elio Castroneves, never sat down and went over the return with him. Nothing. Bell, who has no time records, is my favorite. This guy, you know, you keep time records, that's how you charge your time. There's not a single minute of time with Elio Castroneves. So what does he say? Well, I would go to the races and see Elio there. I mean, I can just see it now. Elio's going into the pit at 200 miles an hour, and Patrick Bell is saying, hey, what about your bookkeeping? You think this kid who's got to put his life in his hand at 250 miles an hour is talking about taxes at the Indianapolis 500? Do you think they'd even let him do that? Well, my favorite in this case, a name you will probably never forget, Guido Chippy. Guido Chippy is in charge of this loan, some type of a document that never goes through. He's in the Pine Bank up here. Does he ever once talk, and Elio lives here, did he ever talk to Elio Castroneves on the phone? Did he ever send him a fax? Did he ever come in and sit down? Did he do anything? Well, who did Guido Chippy talk to? Shirley, in Detroit. Not Elio Castroneves. And then he had him sign documents in blank. And nobody even told them what they're filling in. That's all he is a signature. You know, Elio's good at signing autographs and signing contracts. He has no idea what he's signing. And not only that, he signed it in blank, and Guido Chippy has no problem filling it in. You know, for this kind of a crime that they're charged with, you've got to prove intent. That willfully, intentionally did something the law forbid. And good faith, the court will tell you, is a defense. And the good faith in this case, I suggest, comes from one name, Nelson Slosh Burgess. He testified here in the trial. The lawyer grew up in Brazil, is fluent in Portuguese and English. And Elio and Caddy go to him for a second opinion. They don't know what's going on. They don't understand these contracts. They don't understand this tax stuff. They don't understand what Feingold is telling them. They go for a second opinion. Now, I ask you this to begin with. How many criminals go to get a second opinion about their criminal conspiracy? It just doesn't happen. They go in there and sit down with Schlossberges, who tries to figure this out. Here's the chart. When I was a kid, there was a famous cartoonist called Rube Goldberg, who used to draw up all these kind of machines, all of which made no sense. This is what this reminds me of. I challenge you to take a look at this and figure out what's going on. And this is the lawyer trying to figure it out so he can explain it to them. Then he even amends it to add in some more information over here. This is incomprehensible. And this is the diagram to try to understand the transactions. Could you imagine Elio and Cotty having this described to them in the English language by a tax lawyer from New York City? I challenge you to think that they understood this. Schlossberges tried to understand it, and he gave them some advice, and you can take a look at it. His memo or fax to them is in evidence of Government's Exhibit 167. And what does he say? My tax team, he put together CPAs and lawyers. He couldn't understand it. He had to call other people to try to get an explanation of this. But what is the bottom line? As we advise you, U.S. sourced income will be taxed when it is eventually received. That's the advice they get. Finally, they get somebody to explain it to them in Portuguese. This is over their head, beyond their comprehension. They don't know anything about these kinds of things, so they go and get somebody to explain it to them. Finally, somebody is explaining it to them in a language they can understand. And what does he say? You pay the taxes when you get the money. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line in this case. I wanted to talk to you about some of these professionals, and if I can put this back up. There's a lot of professionals in this case. I wanted to talk a minute about Feingold and Berg. The government said both in Mr. Dwyer's final argument and in Mr. Axelrod's opening statement that this country gives great opportunity and that Elio Castroneves in some way violated that opportunity. I think the biggest opportunity in this case was not by Elio Castroneves, but was by Feingold and Berg. They had the opportunity to take advantage of this young man. And you know, the world is full of this. When you get a young athlete and you get these managers, you get these lawyers, you get these handlers who take advantage of them, and this is one of the worst cases I've ever heard. They charge him at $640 an hour. And by the way, they rang up $28,000 before they even met him. They charged $640 an hour to do what? To sell him the Fintage deal. That's what they're doing. Because Feingold has a deal with Fintage. And if he can sell this to Elio, he is making a killing. Because look what he's doing. He charges Elio $640 an hour to sell him the Fintage deal, where Feingold gets 20% of Fintage's profits. Think about that. Can you imagine? It's like going to a car dealer and you have to pay them to try to sell you the car, and then they get to keep the car after you buy it. It's amazing. They charged him this enormous sum of money, in essence, to sell him their deal. You talk about taking advantage of somebody. And then one of my favorite questions of the trial, Mr. Axelrod on redirect examination asked Mr. Feingold, well, because of this, did you favor one party over another? And his answer, of course not. Of course not. I wouldn't do that. And yet later in the trial, we called people from Brazil. And I think the government cross-examined him that we paid for their airline ticket to come here, and we paid for them to stay at a crummy hotel down in Dadeland and probably bought some fast food for them. And the whole purpose of that is to show somehow they're going to come in here and tell things that aren't true. There's no doubt they're biased because they love Elio and Cotty. But the whole purpose of that is to show some sort of a bias. But when it comes to Fred Feingold at $640 an hour and 20% of the profits on $5 million, oh no, that wouldn't affect old Fred. And do you think he really, and by the way, our expert, Mr. Chase, was $200 an hour cheaper. I feel that we made a pretty good bargain. And what do we find out? If Elio remained a resident, after 5 years in the Fintage program, he loses $98,000. Do you think Fred Feingold, when he was pitching Fintage, told Elio, you're going to pay me some, I don't know, 40, 50, 60,000, I forgot what it was, I get 20% of the Fintage deal, and you lose $98,000? You think he told them that? You think these guys are honest? You think they really sat down and explained that to him? And you wonder why Shakespeare said, let's kill all the lawyers. The court will tell you that you can, you know, the tax code is 5,700 pages. There's another 15,000 pages of regulations trying to tell us what those 5,700 pages mean. So taxpayers have a right to rely upon counsel and accountants, because we all do. And that's a defense in this case. And I thought one of the more extraordinary parts of the case is when Patrick Bell said that he bought Cotty a dictionary. Bought her a dictionary to help her understand the words used in accounting and in tax. But he bought her an English dictionary, English to English. Can you imagine going down to Brazil, trying to figure out the Brazilian tax code, and somebody gives you a Brazilian dictionary with Brazilian words with a Brazilian definition? Good luck trying to figure that one out. Who else could they rely upon? Who else could they rely upon against except all these people? You know, and Elio has to rely on people. This young man, he puts his life in the hands of people. Every way, whether it's the manager, the pit crew, the engineers, whatever it is, he's hoping that they tighten every bolt and every screw and every tire goes on right. You ever see them when they go into those pits and in 7 seconds they put on four tires and put the gas in and wipe your windshield and send you on the way? He should hope that they don't make any mistakes. But he relies on them. And not only that, he signs a contract where if they make a mistake, he absolves them of it. If they make a mistake that takes away his legs, his brain, his body, he's crippled, and he's dead, he absolves them all in that contract. Talk about a man who relies upon others. His entire life he's relied upon others. He relied upon his father, he relies upon his sister, he relied upon his mother with him in England. He relies upon everybody who works on his car, every professional. This young man relies on it, because what does he do? He's so desperate to drive. That's the only thing he cares about in his life. The one passion that he has is to drive, drive, drive. And he relies upon all of them. And are we supposed to punish him because mistakes are made? You think there was a mistake made in Greg Moore's car when he crashed? And when we talk about this, I remember this, what the government said about relying on people, and you know, you wouldn't rely upon people unless you had control over it. I can just think of what's going on in the news right now. There are people like Norman Braman, Steven Spielberg, Elie Wiesel, who's the Nobel laureate, all put money in the hands of Bernard Madoff. $50 billion worth of money this guy got.
People put the money in their hands. They relied upon him. $50 billion. Is it so illogical that Elia would rely upon lawyers and accountants and his father and Osiris and all those people in his life? They try to make it sound like that's somehow extraordinary. But he's done it all his life. Now, in order to overcome this, the government knew that this is a defense, of course. How do they overcome this? They have to get the accountants to say they didn't know. That's the bottom line. I didn't know about Father, even though it's in their own records. Jill Combs comes in here and testifies, well, I didn't know that Father was being paid, even though it's right there in the records of the accounting firm. Mr. Garvin went through that with you. But did you watch her when she was testifying? I mean, she was shaken. You could hear the trembling in her voice. And why is that? She's back in Indiana or Illinois, I forgot what, in her little office. You know, she does accounting and bookkeeping and is one of those people in the middle class that just wants their life, and she gets a letter, what they call a target letter, that these gentlemen over here have the power to send out, and it frightened her to death. She didn't want to be sitting in this courtroom. She knew what could happen to her life, that her life, when you get that letter, your life turns into a nightmare. A nightmare. And it frightens her to death, and she signed some type of contract, which we haven't seen. And what does she say? Well, now I didn't know anything about Father. I didn't even read it in the records. If you have any questions, maybe it happened with the partner. I don't know. But why are these people, Bell, Combs, Feingold, Berg, what is it they're afraid about? Ladies and gentlemen, United States Department of Justice is the world's largest law firm. It has enormous resources, an enormous budget, has very talented and dedicated and persistent people. They have powers beyond what anybody can imagine, from checking your library books to your DNA to your medical records, whatever it is. And the IRS.
Sustained.
And the IRS is part of this case. Special Agent John DeSilva is sitting over here. One of the most powerful law enforcement agencies in the world, bar none. And there are many other agents out there jumping on this brigade. There's incredible power. And they have two of their best lawyers here. Let's face it, these are two excellent lawyers, two excellent advocates. And I give them their due. But despite that, with everything they have going for them, they don't rely upon the facts. They rely upon fictions. We are relying on the evidence. Fact. Elio never received the money. Fiction. It's constructive receipt. Fact. Osiris, we have stipulated to, testifies that Father owns 7. Fiction. Under the rule of attribution, they claim Elio owns it. Fact. Father controlled 7. We know that from the documents, from the testimony, from the stipulations. Fiction. It's a controlled foreign corporation, and non-lineal descendants, if they are U.S. residents, would be attributable to you. Fiction. Despite everything they have, despite these two fine lawyers, despite the IRS, despite all the other agencies they have, and all the power they have, they're relying upon fictions. We are relying on evidence. And you know, the law is full of fictions. There are plenty of them. There are presumptions and inferences, and we have fancy terms like res ipsa loquitur, and I can go on down a whole bunch of Latin terms that could really sound important if I wanted to, but they're all in a civil context. We don't create fictions to convict people of crimes. They have to be based on evidence, not fictions. And then, Alan Miller. Here's a man who made honest mistakes. He knew he was a target, but he wouldn't crumble. He stood up, said, look, I made mistakes. He's a stand-up guy. Of all these professionals,
And, you know, I have to tell you, I'm a little embarrassed about the actions of some of the lawyers in this case, from Yanowitz, who can't even remember a thing. I think he has terminal amnesia. That we have Berg and Feingold, who are making money that's just incredible. And then to come in here with a CYA to say, well, we don't know, my eyes are closed, but to the accountants who are afraid and are abandoning their clients, that's not what professionals do. When you have a client, you've got loyalty. You stand up. You stand by them in thick or thin. What good is a lawyer who gives up at the first time there's a storm cloud, a little litter comes in from over here, they're willing to give up the ship? You know, we lawyers come in and represent people in the toughest times of their lives, whether it involves children or your homes, your money, your freedom, your life. You want lawyers with backbone. And I remember there's a great line from Teddy Roosevelt saying about a judge, that man's got a backbone carved out of a banana. And you know what? Most of the people in this case are just like that. They won't stand up. And there's certain contradictions I wanted to talk about, you know, talking out of both sides of her mouth. When it comes to this thing about debt and Elio Sr. and the government cross-examined Mr. Chaves about this, one time he used the word debt. So they want to turn this into a loan. But putting that aside for a second, do you notice when they want to turn it into a loan, do they require any documents? Do they require a promissory note? Do they require receipts? Do they require anything in writing? Oh, no. If you say it's a debt and a loan, that's perfectly fine with us. But when it comes to a man who spent his life working for his son, when it comes to being paid for that, when it comes to being paid compensation for his work, you better have a contract and you better have receipts. I don't care if that kid's 9 years old. Have him sign a contract. And I think that Mr. Dwyer also mentioned on the cross-examination of Chaves, we had asked him about how much Elio had paid in taxes, and it was about $1.3 million. And Mr. Dwyer, I think, rightfully so, in cross-examination, well, the fact he paid $1 million or $1.5 million, that has no bearing on whether he owes additional taxes. And he asked that in every year, and Mr. Chaves says, that's right. Well, I return the favor right now. Whether there's no bearing to constructive receipt, because it doesn't exist in this case, because the payment was stopped before it was due and owing. There's no bearing to the attribution rules they want to use in this case, because the lineal descendants are not United States taxpayers. There's no bearing in this case about who owes Brazilian taxes. There's no bearing as to what the COIMEX executives were doing with their money. There's no bearing if there was violations of the currency laws of Brazil. There's no bearing that there was a Seven Promotions Corporation. The only bearing in this case is the calculation of his taxes and whether he deliberately, willfully defrauded the United States of what their due was, and he didn't do that. And I finally found out what the conspiracy in this case was. Mr. Dwyer said, well, it's a conspiracy if you intended to commit a constructive receipt of the money. So as I understand it now, we're charged with conspiring to specifically violate some obscure legal fiction embedded deep within the 9,000 sections of the United States tax code, because we were conspiring to do a constructive receipt of the money that we thought was going to go to Elio's retirement. That's absurd. We're charged with conspiring to do something that's not a crime. Not a crime. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you've been very kind in listening to me this afternoon, particularly after lunch. The last thing that I want to talk about are two important concepts. One is the presumption of innocence. Every man, woman, and child who walks into this courtroom is innocent unless proven guilty. innocent unless proven guilty. You have to look at them as if they are innocent, and only when there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt can you convict anyone. And proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest burden of proof we have in any courtroom in the United States of America, because this is a criminal case. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is our mantra. It has to be proven so convincingly to you that it's beyond reasonable doubt, that you are convinced that this is true. Not to make it up, not in fictions, not in presumptions, not in inferences, but with evidence. These may sound like platitudes, but they are the truth. The eternal truth, the simple truth. And generation after generation after generation, the Constitution of the United States continues to repeat these truths. It is part of our inheritance. It was written into the Bill of Rights by the great men who created this country, and it gives us the riches of freedom and liberty. This is a hallowed place. This is a place where justice is done. In the history of our country, many men and women have suffered the heat of injustice because these rights were denied them. Denied because of discrimination, bias, prejudice, hatred. But we still believe in the American dream. We still believe in the ideals of this country. This country is great. From sea to shining sea, it is the beacon of hope and freedom.